Call a meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. We're continuing today with the DE, was it four? Amendment from yesterday. We would like to have someone offer a motion to accept the minutes from April 14th.
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
If I recall, you did that yesterday, too. And you're getting better at it. Thank you very much. The motion has been made by Representative Christensen, approving the April 14th minutes. Any questions? Otherwise, all vote in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are approved. Just want to make a quick comment that we're sorry that there was some confusion as far as when testimony would be taken on our bill. So now we get 2 days in testimony. So it actually turns out better, perhaps, hopefully. So we don't want to exclude anyone. First of all, we'd like to welcome President Kaler from the University of Minnesota. And we appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for having me. For the record, I'm Eric Kaler. I'm the president of the University of Minnesota, and I'm sorry I wasn't here as yesterday, as the chair alluded to. We missed some communications, and I apologize if there was an inconvenience. But I was in Morris at the University of Minnesota Morris, filling a longstanding commitment to visit that beautiful campus. But I am here today, and I must tell you that I am deeply disappointed that you have decided to provide a zero increase in new funding for the universities, the university. The university in many ways is the heartbeat of the economy of Minnesota, wellspring of creativity and culture in the state. Mr. Chairman, you and I have talked. I've talked with members of the committee, and I understand the politics. But for you and members of the committee, which is charged with nurturing Minnesota's exceptional higher education ecosystem, I have to tell you this, that in light of a $2 billion state budget surplus, I believe a 0% increase for the university is not an acceptable outcome. And in fact, public opinion research shows it's unacceptable to a vast majority of Minnesotans, many of whom are in your constituents. At last count, 5,132 of our students come from your districts. And according to public opinion research conducted in December, just 4 months ago, 69% of Minnesotans believe the university is not getting enough funding from the state. And that's up more than 4 percentage points from the previous year. Your proposal will not allow us to freeze tuition. Yet, I think we all agree that the cost of higher education is a critical issue for Minnesota students and families. If this proposal stands, our students will face a tuition increase of 3%. That will be my recommendation to the Board of Regents. A zero increase would stymie our efforts to improve our medical school and our entire research enterprise. We are Minnesota's only public research university, and that work attracts hundreds of millions of dollars of federal and other sponsored research dollars across into the state. I think this proposal is a step backwards for the partnership between the legislature and the university. That relationship between this committee, others in the body, and the university was strengthened in the last biennium when you partnered with us to freeze undergraduate Minnesota resident tuition. We did our part of the partnership and reduced administrative costs. We have dramatically improved our four-year graduation rates. Our faculty and researchers have produced record numbers of patents and startup companies. We've kept the University of Minnesota affordable for students from low-income families. We've exceeded all of the performance goals that were set for us by the legislature. We do believe we have done our part. One other thing, the Board of Regents, my bosses, supported our biennial budget request to the legislature. And while I haven't spoken to every regent in the past 24 hours, I would hazard a guess that a zero increase in our base funding is not acceptable to them either. Let me quickly outline what a 0% increase will look like for a typical Minnesota high school graduate, now one of our students. That is about 71% of all of our undergraduate students on our Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and Twin Cities campus. It will look like a 3% increase in undergraduate tuition for Minnesota-based residents and about a 3.5% increase for graduate students, depending on their discipline of field or field of study. That impact is an immediate increase of $362 a year, but going forward, it adds up. From families in your districts alone, that totals $1.8 million. Depending on which of our campuses the student attends, that will also amount to between $2,100 and $2,600 of additional payments over 4 years. I have worked very hard to reduce administrative costs and reallocate those dollars to teaching, research, and community engagement. Some members of the committee have asked why we need the state partnership to freeze tuition. That is, why can't we do it on our own? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have already done our part to keep a lid on tuition. Through our reallocations and with your partnership, we have reduced the need for tuition increases. For each $15 million that we have reallocated from administrative costs, we have reduced the need for tuition increases by 2.1%. So far, over the past 2 years, we've redirected $39 million of administrative costs to core mission activities. And that is, but for those reallocations, we'd need to generate 2.1% more revenue, either from students' tuition or state funding. Each year, we have new, additional, and necessary, mostly inflationary costs, just like any Minnesota household would. For example, we must meet increases in the millions of dollars in the cost of subscriptions for our libraries, and those libraries serve as a statewide asset. We need to invest in new technology and laboratory equipment, and as you know, we have not received the amount of HEPA money that we've requested over time to keep our buildings well-maintained, safe, and accessible. As family income stays flat across the nation, the demand for financial aid has increased, and we must attract and retain world-class talent of our faculty and staff by providing appropriate compensation. Over the past 3 years, our compensation pool has been a modest 2% annually. So to keep a lid on the face of those rising costs, we've reallocated internally and are requesting over the upcoming biennium $65.2 million to plug what would otherwise be a 3% tuition increase. Let me move on to the impact on research that this zero increase proposal will have. Research helps the U attract to the state more than $700 million of funding from federal agencies, foundations, and private industries as they seek new treatments, cures, products, and processes to improve lives. It's created a culture of innovation that's given life to the state's medical device, mining, and food industries, among others. Specifically, in our current request, this zero increase would stall health care and medical research investments and would strike a blow in our efforts to improve our medical school. If you recall, our original request sought to fund six clinics around the state to bring health care delivery to underserved areas. And we know there's a shortage of health care professionals in Greater Minnesota, and we want to partner with you to address that. Our request will help meet the health care needs of our state's aging and increasingly diverse population. Our request will bring more dentists to rural Minnesota. In fact, I have a letter from the mayors of Ely and Winton and from supervisors from a number of Iron Range communities imploring us to train more dentists to serve in their communities. Our request is also targeted to bring our resources and expertise to communities statewide to help close the achievement and opportunity gaps in our schools. In addition, as recommended by a Blue Ribbon Commission established by Governor Dayton, our request would fund researchers and increase NIH grant awards and overall improve the ranking of the medical school. And a 0% increase does none of that. That vision would be gone, and who knows what history will not be made. And finally, while I'm at it, let me say a word about the cost of education. Paying for college, whether it be the University of Minnesota, Winona State, or McAllister, is expensive for many families. But we at the university, through various sources, scholarship, work study, or tuition waivers, provide almost $250 million in financial aid, not loans, to degree-seeking undergraduates on all of our campuses. Higher education is an investment by the student and her family in her future and in our state's future. It's true that there is a cost to higher education, but it's a cost that the university, our students, and you, our elected officials and policymakers, should fairly share. There must be a balance so that there is a public and public higher education. That's what the next generation of this state deserves. That's what our citizens and your constituents, I believe, expect. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to come before your committee.
Thank you, President Kaler, for being here today. I have a question, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, how much funding are we allocating to the University of Minnesota in the next biennium?
Mr. Fitzenreiter?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Richard Fitzenreiter, the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer of the University of Minnesota. And I believe the base O&M and state special funding in your bill is just shy of $600 million a year. That's without any of the increase that we requested.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you. So about $1.2 billion over the next 2 years.
Mr. Chairman, that is the correct number. It equates relative to the budget resolution or house targets for your overall spending with the university share of the state budget would be at an historic low of 2.8%.
Okay. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, President Kaler, for being here, and I apologize for being late. I'm actually supposed to be in another committee right now, so I'm kind of going to end up going back and forth. So you'll have to forgive me for missing the first part of your testimony, but I just have a couple of things. I actually went to the University of Minnesota for 6 years, and I feel like I've learned more about the higher ed and the university in the past 3 months serving on this committee than I did in 6 years, which, you know, it's just a steep learning curve. But I had several concerns with some of the things that I've learned over the past few months, and I actually did have the opportunity to meet with some folks from the University of Minnesota the other day. So originally I had three amendments that I was going to propose, and I've held off. I'm hoping that through some conversations we can address some of these issues. But one of them is actually taxpayer dollars going to the University of Minnesota. And you mentioned constituents' expectations that we fund the university and higher education. And when I door knock, honestly, that it's very rare that that comes up. But what I will say my constituents, I think, expect is transparency. And with the University of Minnesota and the budget requests and the way that I've been walked through the budget a handful of times, I still have a hard time understanding where exactly all of the money and the $1.2 billion that we gave previously and that we're going to give again is actually going. With our priority being tuition freezes, and that's what we want to see, it sounds like you would have the ability to do that in various ways if we were not prioritizing other things like world-class compensation, or I forget how you phrase it, for faculty. So being a world-class institution, while a great priority, does conflict then with freezing tuition. So my question is regarding taxpayer dollars in the budget. I have a bill or an amendment that would have the University of Minnesota track state dollars showing specifically where state money is going into the University of Minnesota budget. And I'm hoping that through conversations we can get more clarity on that and how that works. And I guess for right now, I don't really have a question necessarily, but more or less just hoping that we can continue in conversations about this issue, because I do find it very concerning. And actually, I see some of the regents here as well, which I really appreciate. And I'm hoping to meet with some of the regents as well to talk about the budget issues that we're facing and how we can move forward being more transparent to constituents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, may I offer a comment?
Sure. President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whalen, we will continue to work with you in understanding the budget. It is sounds like a little bit of a cop-out to say it is complex, but it is truly complex. But I am very comfortable that we can assure you that we put state dollars to very high and worthwhile purposes, and we'll illustrate that to the best of our ability.
Anyone else have a question of President Kaler, Representative Dorton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell us, I know in when we talk K-12, we usually talk about with the budget, 80% goes to staff. Is that a similar percent, or what percent goes to your staff salaries?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Dorton, it's a little bit north of 60%, 60%. So we have in the U a higher need for infrastructure support to buy equipment, other things that are not salary related, but it's a little bit more than 60%.
Representative Norton, your name is tipped over.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Any other questions for President Kaler? Or I know there's a student here that would like to also testify. Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, President Kaler, for being here today. You had mentioned how much you felt tuition would increase for non-resident, or excuse me, for residents. About 3%, 2 to 3, I think, is what was heard yesterday. You had mentioned $360 a year over 4 years, roughly $1,500. What would be, what's your plan for non-resident tuition at the moment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, we will continue to grow the difference between Minnesota resident and non-resident tuition. As you know and we have discussed, the previous strategy had been to hold that difference relatively make the difference relatively small with the idea of attracting out-of-state students to Minnesota. We feel like we have built that pipeline and that it is appropriate that out-of-state students may pay more of the cost of their education, so we're going to grow that. We, of course, there is a maximum in that curve where it will begin to affect the yield of out-of-state students. So my goal would be to get us in the middle of the Big Ten in terms of that difference, while keeping a close eye on enrollment, because it's important not only that out-of-state students pay more money, but they bring an important experience to the university, and in fact, we are a talent magnet. Many of those students will graduate and stay in Minnesota and contribute to our economy.
Representative Barrett.
A follow-up. Thank you. Where is President Kaler, where is Minnesota currently in the Big Ten as it relates to non-resident tuition?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, I do not know the exact number. I may have a friend in the audience who does, but it's near the bottom for sure. Levy, if I may ask.
Second
from the bottom. So we have room to go.
Follow up then. So if we were to get to the middle of the Big Ten, if one of your numbers folks could tell me how much the yearly tuition would increase each year, so that we'd still be in the middle of the Big Ten. I'm thinking it's about $7,000, $8,000 a year that we could increase and be in the middle. If we increased it $4,000 a year, we would, I believe my numbers show me, we would be still second from the bottom to Nebraska. And, of course, we are a better institution than Nebraska, so that wouldn't be that big a deal. But if you could just tell me how much we could increase, or you could increase, tuition each year for non-residents to get to your goal of being in the middle of the Big Ten.
Chair Nornes, Representative Barrett, we can do that. I probably can't do it right off the top of my head. We can show you that. The real concern in this, though, is the yield. And so if we for two reasons. One is new students who may see that as an okay thing, but we have students already in the pipeline who would see a dramatic increase, and that affects their family and their students' planning. We haven't been eager to go to a two-tiered system where a class would pay a certain level and another class behind them would pay a higher level, but we have done some modeling on yield expectations, and I take your point that we should move on this as aggressively as we can while maintaining the enrollments.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Final comment, thank you. I think there is an opportunity, and rather than comment directly on your initial thoughts to our committee, I would just offer in response a opportunity for resources that is at your fingertips, that has been there for many years, that you are ever so gently tipping in into, in which if you were more aggressive, that might solve some of the financial issues that you brought to our attention. Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler yesterday asked Mr. Ouellette for a total cost impact of a zero funding increase from the legislature on the university, assuming the tuition increase that you just mentioned. And the number that I got back was that if the legislature does not increase funding for the university and you seek 3 and 3 tuition increases, the total cost for all students at the university will be $65 million. And there is a notion that I've heard that somehow the university has other places it can go to find money to offset the zero increase from the legislature, and I just wonder if you have places you can go to find $65 million.
President Kaler.
Chair Nornes, Representative Winkler, I wish I did. We have two principal revenue sources for the university, obviously, state aid and tuition. If one of those is lacking, the other one needs to provide that. We, again, are, after creating and maintaining a world-class excellent research university, not always being the cheapest educational alternative. And so we feel that increasing tuition would be necessary for us to maintain our operations. We do have considerable philanthropy, some of which is the source of the $250 million in financial gift aid that I mentioned in my testimony, and that makes us more accessible, but not necessarily cheaper.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next question, I guess, maybe this is better for Mr. Fitzenreiter. In the last legislative budget, we significantly increased the funding going to the University of Minnesota, but that is in the context of being in a pretty deep hole from years past. So I wonder if you could just briefly describe for the committee where the current level of funding stands at $1.2 billion in historic terms, and maybe just kind of give us a little history of the last 10 to 15 years.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our original ask of the legislature before the, even with the governor's added Blue Ribbon Commission money, if we were granted all of those dollars, our funding level would be about what it was just before the Great Recession. It would get us back to that level of unadjusted for inflation. This flat budget, I'm just going to venture to say, I think it's probably back at the early part of 2002, 3, 4 in there. I'll verify that for you. But the funding level that we asked for would have just got this back to the level right before the Great Recession. Not accounting for inflation.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, so, and Mr. Fitzenreiter, I mean, that's not really, it's frankly, not really an accurate number to not include inflation at all in that. You're talking, you know, those are different dollars in 2002 than what we have now. And so your request, I mean, this is just something we all need to realize, your request with a $2 billion budget surplus, your request would put us back in uninflated dollars where you were in 2007. Something like that. Minnesota just had the marker of being one of the first states to recover all the jobs that were lost during that recession, and this legislature is determined, it seems to me, to keep our institutions of higher education and many of the most prized and important parts of our economic recovery back in recession levels. And I just think I appreciate your coming today and expressing the sense of the university about this. But there's no good way to have a strong economy in the future without innovation and talent. And that's what the university provides to us in spades, and we need to take better care of it than this budget represents.
Representative Baird, have another question?
Yeah, just thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up to my question earlier. How many non-resident undergraduate students do you have at the U of M?
President Kaler?
Chairman Nornes, Representative Baird, it's 13% of the entering freshman class. The entering freshman class is about 5,500 students, so that would give us a little under 600 students from out of state.
So
I have this right, actually 650 from out of state.
Mr. Chair, President Kaler, how many in total do you have? I mean, that would just be your freshman class. My numbers show about 6,000. I could be wrong, off by a few hundred here or there.
Mr. President. Chair, Representative Burr, of the entering class?
No. How many undergraduate non-resident students do you have? Undergraduate being undergraduate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnett.
Can you repeat that, President Kaler, because that wasn't picked up on the mic.
May I simply invite Vice Provost McMaster to the podium to give the answer to that question?
Identify yourself.
or state your name and then
sure. Robert McMaster, Vice Provost and Dean of Undergraduate Education on the Twin Cities campus. So in terms of your question, the numbers are based on the percent non-resident in the transfer class plus the percent non-resident in the freshman class. The freshman class would be 13% of 5,500. Sorry, if I could get my calculator, I'll give you the numbers.
I'll do it for you.
Okay. And then about 17% reciprocity. So about 30% of the freshman class are either reciprocity or non-resident, plus another 6% are international.
So,
Representative Barrett?
You know, I'll end with this, but if you could just get me a number. Sure. I mean, it really shouldn't depend on a percent of residents. It really is a unique number based on how many kids don't live in Minnesota and don't have reciprocity. So that's the number I'm looking for. My point, though, goes back to my original issue, which I think President Kaler and I agree on, which is there is a source of money. There is a source of funds that is available that would cover a large part of that. If we just have non-residents pay an appropriate amount for the tuition that they receive, the good tuition they receive from Minnesota. Because as we know, I think we know, we should know by now, in the time of budget cuts, the U of M made a decision to reduce non-resident tuition prior to President Kaler getting here by $6,000, went from $22,000 to $16,000. Mm-hmm. At a time of tight budgeting times, tuition went down. It went down for the wrong group, in my opinion, but it did go down. So if we just correct that situation, there is millions of dollars available at your disposal. Would it cover the total amount? I'm not sure, probably not, but there is money available.
I forgot your name already, but
Robert McMaster.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, Chair Norris, members of the committee. I agree that the university made or created a precipitous drop in tuition. At the same time, at that moment, we had a very low number of out-of-state students. And one of the strategies to build the non-resident number was to lower tuition initially, as President Kaler said, and then over a period of time build the pipelines that were necessary and then start to increase non-resident up. We did not have a strong national reputation at the time. We've built that. We've gone from probably 4 to 5% non-resident up to 13% in the freshman class. That continues to grow each year. And we have been raising the non-resident tuition by about $1,000 a year over the last 2 to 3 years, again, to get up to that point in the middle of the Big Ten.
My final point, Mr. Chair, is that if you raised it 4,000, I'm repeating myself, but I think the point is worth saying again. If you increased tuition $4,000, you would still be second lowest only to Nebraska, and kids who graduate from Nebraska are in Lincoln, Nebraska when they're done. Kids who graduate from U of M are in the Twin Cities. Big difference in our favor. Sure. Thank you.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up a little bit regarding the complexity of the university budget and just some comments that were made regarding potential finding for ways that the university could find some cost savings. When I had met with the university, they did send me some information, and I did some research as well. So I actually, President Kaler, want to commend you for looking into the Umore Park issue. There was an article about that in the Star Trib a little while ago, that the U spent nearly $12.5 million on administration, planning, and development between 2006 and 2014, but that revenue or expenses overtook revenue by about $3.5 million. And so looking into that and trying to figure out the best way to move forward, and I don't know if the Board of Regents has come to a decision on that. I'd be interested to know. And then another example of some, I think, potential cost savings, looking at one of the programs that was sent, there was a list of FTEs with it, and for four FTEs for one program, it was over $1 million for the biennium, which is a little bit over $100,000 per person per year, which for me, I mean, one of the positions I think was an administrative assistant position, so maybe that person gets less while, you know, another person gets more. Just seems a little bit high to me. So I'm wondering if, you know, calling for a task force similar to how you did for the Umore Park to say, hey, can we look into ways that the university can save money or find, or how can we do this?
President Kaler.
Chairman Norris, excuse me. Representative Whalen, we meet every Tuesday at 2 o'clock, a group of vice presidents and myself, in an operational excellence meeting where we work hard at a high level in directing how to make those cuts. That's how we've come up with a $39 million reduction. We use selectively external expertise to guide us in organizational structure and in compensation. We measure our compensation against our peer groups. On the upper administration side, we are actually well below the median compensation across the board in our upper administration. We benchmark our faculty salaries very carefully because we have to, because our best faculty get poached by other institutions. Now, we do a little poaching now and then, too, but we have to be competitive there. And we are in a large metro area that's not Lincoln, Nebraska, and so staff have salary opportunities outside the university, and many of our staff work for the university for less compensation than they would get elsewhere because they believe in the value of public higher education. So external validation of that compensation structure is really important, and we work hard on the operational excellence activities on a weekly basis.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Thank you for that explanation. So that's, I think, a good start for the compensation area. But beyond that, too, like the UMore Park issue and other areas, programmatic costs, et cetera, can you just expand a little bit on how you're handling that issue?
Certainly. Mr. Taylor? Chair, Representative Whalen, I'm sorry, I forgot the first part of your UMore question. We did spend money on the planning and implementation of a UMore Park strategy. Much of that spending, I think it was...
No statement.
Yeah.
No statement. Mr. Chairman, just that...
Mr. President,
in terms of the dollars spent on the planning and development at UMore Park, there was no state funds spent in that effort. The money that we have spent in that effort has come from the gravel mining and permitting process that's underway at UMore Park, and those dollars will continue to reimburse that account, but we did not spend any state dollars in that effort.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whalen, so much of that money was necessary to get the gravel mining going. That is cash flowing and will be a net resource to the university. What the board did do was pivot from a development strategy of other areas to focus on the core agricultural mission that is served by some of that land, and to realize that we would be better off letting the private sector, the market, dictate the speed and kind of development that would take place on the rest of the property. And the city and township are comfortable with that decision, but we will ultimately make money from the proceeds of the gravel.
Representative
Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final comment. So thank you for that, President Kaler, and I'll look forward to having more conversations about this in the future. And thank you for the clarification on no state money for that program. It raises the point, I think, to my earlier comment about a potential bill or amendment that would request the university to provide to us where exactly state money is going, because even though it may not have gone to that program specifically, I would say the budget itself, the $3 billion that you spend, if $1 billion of that, a third of that comes from the state, if state money is not going there and other money is going there, there would still be a way to reallocate or use various funds to make sure that the money is being spent the best way possible. So if there is money being spent at the U in a way that is not being optimal, that does actually affect your request for state money. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you should ask us if we spend our money in the optimal possible way, and I should be able to tell you yes. And my answer is yes, and we get better every day we work on it.
Members, we have a bill to pass yet sometime today, so I'm not going to shut off discussion, but just to keep that in mind. Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I want to thank you for coming today. 2 years ago, I think your presence when we passed the higher ed bill then made a difference not just in the content of the bill that was before us, but in the ultimate resolution of the conference committee and what we did for higher education. I also want to thank the regents that are here today, including the chair, but particularly one of the newest regents who was just elected, who was here yesterday, who I'm crediting with making sure everybody showed up today. President Kaler, your comments today underscored that the tuition freeze is still your number one priority. It also underscores your understanding of the consequences of what happened during the Great Recession when we did cut higher ed by record amounts, the U in particular by record amounts nationally, and the debt that has been the consequence of those tuition increases and those cuts. I also want to thank you, which you have done in the past, the frankness of your comments. You took stands in 2013 and 14 on the sources of revenue that supported your budget. You did not have to do that, but you did. You frankly said we needed to raise revenue, we needed to make this investment, and your comments today are exactly the same as they were in 2013 and 2014. And I thank you for that. I would hope, as you have stated, that with a budget surplus of almost $2 billion, we would not put more debt on the backs of students at the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, or in the private colleges with what's happened with the grant program. So I thank you today and the Regents today. While this bill is not what all of us wanted, I would hope that your presence today and the Regents' presence today will result in a much better bill when we finally resolve the conference committee and interaction with Governor Dayton. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, thank you.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, President Kaler, and probably Mr. Fitzenreiter. My question is, where have you primarily seen the increases in costs over the last decade, maybe we'll say? And, this doesn't necessarily cover, this isn't all, President Kaler's tenure. I'd like to really sincerely thank you for the $90 million commitment to cut administrative costs. That's something that's important to me. I'm a University of Minnesota student, and, that's something that means a lot to me. Certainly the university's budget has grown, whether it's been from state appropriations or from tuition over the last 10 years, and where have you primarily seen the increases in costs? Has it been on the administrative side, or has it been on the, say, teaching and instruction side, or does food in the cafeteria cost more? Where primarily have the increases been coming?
President Kaler.
Chairman Nornes, Representative Christensen, let me take the first stab at that and ask Vice President Fitzenreiter to amend and correct after I do. Cost drivers in higher education are similar to cost drivers everywhere. Compensation, inflationary adjustments for compensation. Costs of benefits have increased, although I will brag the university, Vice President Brown, has done an exceptional job at controlling the cost of benefits, but they still have risen. The cost of technology, and particularly information in the library subscriptions, has increased. And the general inflationary costs that any pressure any company feels, whether it's fuel, whether it's maintenance, whether it's food in the cafeteria, those are all major cost drivers. Again, my focus on the split between administrative costs and mission support cost and mission, I think, is crystal clear to this group. We are focused on moving dollars out of administration, reallocating those to mission and education. So, Mr. Fitzreiner.
Yeah, I
Mr.
would just Reiter. Echo that with saying also that, over the last decade, but even longer, I mean, the explosion in the cost and the demand for technology has been enormous for higher education. In other words, there's just more demand, it's in, as I testified here before, we're in the dark period, lights out period of a major business system upgrade at the University of Minnesota. We'll go live on April 20th with a new HR, new student system, and reconnecting our financial system to that new PeopleSoft. That alone cost the university over the last 3 years $83 million to do that. We will have a $1.7 million new cost next year just for the licensing of the software from Oracle, PeopleSoft. Those technology expenses, coupled with an aging infrastructure of buildings and utilities, has added a lot more costs, frankly, in the last 10 years than pay raises have at the University of Minnesota.
We have a few more questions. If we can keep them clear and concise, and hopefully the answer is the same. Gruenhagen, Representative Gruenhagen.
In the interest of time, I came in late, which is my own fault. And,
okay.
So I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Eisen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Approximately how many academic departments do you have at the U?
President Kaler?
Approximately, just ballpark.
Chair Nornes, Representative Isaacson.
You just call me Ike. That's cool.
Thank you, Representative Ike. I really should have prepped for numbers for today's session. Let me give you an estimate.
Sure.
I would say we have 150 departments.
Any degree, how many majors you have?
We have among the largest number of majors of any university in the country. We probably have well over 200 majors.
Sure. Who are your academic peers?
We view ourselves as in the peers in the conversation with the best public research universities in the country, which are many of them nearly as big as we are. Michigan, UCLA, Texas, Virginia, Madison, Wisconsin, University of Washington would be a reasonable peer group.
Do you have any idea how much research dollars you bring back? I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. On a roll here.
Short, but not fast.
Okay. Got a lot of caffeine flowing.
All right. That's all right.
Blowing a little bit.
Representative.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair. How much research dollars do you think you bring in a year? Do you have an idea of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ike, we bring in about $800 million. We're the eighth largest public research university in the country.
Thank you.
Representative Isaac.
Mr. Chair, it confounds me when we have a university of this stature and size that's known nationally and internationally that provides some of the best education you're going to find in the world that we couldn't find a way to fund them better when we have a surplus. What they bring back and the return on the investment and the amount of support they provide our state, not only just in educating our students, but with research and the kind of technology they bring, it seems ludicrous to me that we're sitting here trying to penny pinch in different departments and make suggestions of how we can find a way to spend our dimes a little better when we're talking about a multi-million dollar organization that's having a national impact. So I sincerely hope that we can reconsider that as we get closer to conference committee and maybe right-size our focus on this university. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, we had a wonderful discussion in my office, and I was very excited when you started talking about your collaboration with local businesses and corporations. And being, you know, we have 19 Fortune 500 companies right here in the metro area. We have diversity like no other. I have actually toured several of your research facilities. It was a pleasure to see the MnDrive project. It was a pleasure to see the Stem Cell Research Center. And Dr. Jacob Tolar is probably one of the most renowned, I'm just going to say in our nation, maybe the world, I don't know, but he was quite impressive. You know, and of course, you know that my daughter was just accepted to the U. I was very excited to know that she'll be in the Carlson School of Business. So in light of all that, and in that conversation that we had specifically about the U joining, you talked about that as being sort of a new or an expanded version of what they had done in the past, of expanding into the realm of partnering with businesses and providing them intellectual property and there being some compensation. Can you just, in the light of maybe thinking outside the box of us just appropriating and, you know, another idea of what we could do, can you just expand upon that conversation that we had in my office just a little bit about that new venture that you're doing with local businesses here and that spur of inspiration?
Chair Nornes, Representative O'Neill, I'd be delighted to do so. I will be brief, Mr. Chair. We have a variety of ways to engage with businesses. We have now a University Office of Economic Development, where we work very hard to be the front door for businesses, so that we're eager to respond to their needs, whether it be for training or for a solution to research projects. We have lowered the barrier around our intellectual property to enable facile communication and interactions with companies and faculty members. We have a national leading model for this. I was very pleased to hear recently that some people from the University of Wisconsin were coming over to see how we do it. This is becoming known as the Minnesota model around the country for managing intellectual property exchanges with companies. We've executed, I think, well over 100 master agreements with companies. We're open for business, and we're eager to be the intellectual partner of Minnesota and United States business.
Just a quick follow-up. So in all of that new venture and projecting into the future, do you have any way to quantify maybe what additional revenue might be coming in through these new ventures?
Chair Norton, as Representative O'Neill, I again don't have that number on the top of my head, but we certainly do expect, as we grow the number of those interactions, the research dollars associated with that activity will grow. Those dollars, while they do pay an indirect cost for the use of facilities, are earmarked for, obviously, execution of that particular research project, so they're not broadly available for institutional use.
Thank you, President Kidd.
Well, I think we can excuse both of you now. Thank you for your comments. We have a student. We'll get to him next. So we thank you for being here and for a good discussion. A lot of good questions, good answers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay. Drew? I'll have you pronounce your last name.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Drew Cavio, and I'm a senior at the U of M on the Twin Cities campus. And I'm here representing the undergraduate student government at the University of Minnesota, as well as the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition, which represents students across all five campuses of the University of Minnesota. From Rochester to Morris to Crookston to Duluth to right here in the Twin Cities, U of M students influence many quarters of the state in very important ways. And while all of our campuses are unique, students from across the state come to you today with a clear and unified message. House File 845 is not good for the U of M or for Minnesota. I'm here with 3 points specifically. The first is the lack of increased funding for the U of M system. Now, I can't speak on specific points of the budget like representatives from the U of M, President Kaler and Vice President Fitzenreiter just did, but I do know that we, university, its students, and the legislature all share a common vision for the future of the U of M. And that includes both excellence and affordability, and House File 845 includes neither of those. We ask, as students, that you seriously reconsider the way that you have allocated state dollars, as excellence and affordability can only be had with an increased investment in the U of M. The second point is the way in which this bill finances its priorities. HF 845 includes a reallocation of nearly $50 million from the state grant program. The effect of this, as Commissioner Hogemiller suggested yesterday, is a decrease of $100 to $200 per student recipient. Now, the number of University of Minnesota students who receive state grant support is over 10,000. Need-based grants like this help students choose a college which best fits their needs in the best way possible, rather than choosing institutions or a set of institutions as winners or losers through direct appropriation. We are certainly open to discussing changes to the state grant program in ways that more accurately reflect the cost of college. We ask that you reconsider your decision regarding state grant deduction, as it is a program that can positively impact students with demonstrated need at any of Minnesota's excellent institutions. Third and finally is the sheer number of students. This is tens of thousands that will be impacted by the committee decision to limit its decisions on affordability to minuscule. More importantly, this sets a precedent within our state in terms of how we fund the higher education systems and how dangerous it is to prioritize one over the other in a dramatic way like HF 845, when all systems in Minnesota have a distinct purpose. Without a U of M tuition freeze, the average U of M student, much like myself, will face a cost increase of $2,500, I think they said $2,100 to $2,600 over 4 years. State grant recipients will lose assistance over 4 years under the terms of this bill. These are students who yield a high return on investment for the state. These are citizens of Minnesota who should not be faulted in terms of the funding scheme for the institution they attended. Finally, these are your constituents, with many of our districts having hundreds or thousands of U of M students living in them. With that, I want to thank members of the committee and Mr. Chair for your time, and I'll answer any questions to the best of my abilities.
Thank you, Drew, for your presentation, and good luck in school. I don't see any questions, so again, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Next, we'd like to hear from the Minnesota Private College Council, Connor. Is it Ellinghausen? Am I right? Close? kind of? Well, for the record, that's how you pronounce your name. No, it's not. Maybe you can correctly pronounce your name to us and then begin your testimony if you're first. Or you're not first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cirkvenik, president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Today, like a number of other days over the course of the last 3 months, we've had students from our colleges here talking to legislators about the state grant program. Today, it's a special group of students, some of whom are still here. All of them are government, student government leaders at our institutions. The ones that didn't have to get back for class or work are staying here for the hearing. And we're grateful that you provided an opportunity to hear from a couple of our student government leaders. So I'll just ask the students to introduce themselves and go ahead.
Identify yourself and then proceed.
Alyssa Heim, Hamline University. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of our students at all of our 17 nonprofit private colleges across the state. My name is Alyssa Heim, and I'm the student body president at Hamline University. I'm also a recipient of the state grant. I urge you to support the state grant because it is important to low-income students, not just at Minnesota's private colleges, but for students who attend MinSU schools and the University of Minnesota. Several students were here today at the legislature from our 17 colleges meeting with members about the importance of the state grant program. While many of them had to leave for classes and jobs, several are still here in the audience. I'd like to introduce one of them, Connor Ellinghuizen, who is going to tell you his state grant story.
Welcome, Connor.
Mr. Chair and members, first off, I'd like to say thank you for allowing me to be here to give a testimony. I am a senior at St. Mary's University in Winona, Minnesota, and I am also a recipient of the state grant.
Can you state your name again for the record, please?
Yep. My name is Connor Ellinghuizen.
Thank you. Yep.
One out of four Minnesota residents receives a state grant. And the state grant program is important because it targets the low and middle income families like mine who have the greatest need. I know in my experience when I was choosing a school, St. Mary's came up because of the state grant. Without the state grant, I would not have the opportunity to choose where I wanted to go. My parents made it very clear to me that, especially with college debt being very scary, that they would not be able to help me afford to go to school. The state grant gave me that opportunity to choose to go to St. Mary's, and I do not regret that decision at all. St. Mary's has allowed me to open the doors to my future. It has also allowed me to figure out truly who I am and what I am supposed to be doing. St. Mary's has allowed me to do such things as actually put solar panels up on my campus without asking the university to chip in any money or anything like that, and that's an experience that I know I had because I was able to choose St. Mary's. The state grant fosters student choice so that students can attend college that fits them the best, whether or not it is public or private, and I think that's important for everyone to consider. I'm proud to say that I will be graduating in only 4 years, and my debt is under $20,000 because of the state grant. I plan to stay in Minnesota as a taxpayer and work in higher education, and I plan to continue my education as a master's here in Minnesota as well. The state grant helps students at all colleges hold down additional borrowing, and I am grateful that choosing St. Mary's has helped set me for success and on-time graduation. I hope that you will consider investing in the state grant program so that more students can have the opportunity to go to our colleges and have the choice to where they want to go to, graduating on time. Thank you.
Thank you. So your direction into higher education, where is that going to take you?
Mr. Chair, so I have been for the last 2 years the intern in our admission office at St. Mary's. From that, I am actually going to continue on as an admission counselor, and from there, I look to work actually in higher education administration someday.
Okay. Very good. Thank you for being here and for your testimony.
Thank you.
For both of you, all three of you. Any questions of these young people? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I might just
last
say, our students and myself personally have visited with all of you, and we've heard many very strong, positive expressions of support for the state grant program. So it's really a deep disappointment to see that this bill, at this point in the process, makes a significant reduction in the state grant program. I looked on the Office of Higher Education's website for historical data about state grant appropriations, and there's never been a significant biennium to biennium reduction in state grant funding going back to 1988. That's the first year they have data up on their website. We think that that the state grant program is probably the one of the best investments the state can make in higher education, because it targets the resources you have to students with the greatest need, like Connor and Alyssa, and it helps them graduate on time and graduate without overburdensome debt. So I just want to say that on behalf of our colleges, we want to work with you in the process going forward to help achieve a positive outcome for state grant funding, so that the program can continue to do the many good things it does for the students who are trying to get through college but have the greatest financial barriers to success. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have several other people who need to testify before we get on to the bill. And we thank you for your patience of waiting. Maybe the pages could make room up at the testifying desk. Maybe remove a chair or two, I think. Who's the testifier in your... they didn't leave, did they?
They stepped out into the hall.
They'll be back? Okay, all right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
While you're waiting, I'm participating in this Keep It Civil Minnesota, so I have to be really careful what I say, but I really take issue with the insult to Cornhuskers. As a Cornhusker and a graduate of the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, I didn't stay in Lincoln, and in fact, there are so many Nebraskans in Rochester, Minnesota, that Valentino's Pizza from Lincoln moved to Rochester and opened a branch there. So lots of good people working in Minnesota. I'm just from Nebraska. I just want to make that really clear.
I'm glad you were able to vent and get that out of your system. Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I retract that statement. I have uncles from Lincoln, and my first job actually was in Valentino's Pizza in South Dakota. So Nebraska, South Dakota, we kind of share a similar feel about life. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to the testifying table, both of you. And you want to identify yourself first for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matthew Roderick. Committee members, I've met with many of you, so I think you probably remember me. Briefly, let me just start by saying about 6.5 years ago, my son was injured, became a quadriplegic. And I did not look like this, in case you were wondering. Back then, I managed an emergency department, and I wore a tie just about every day. And I wasn't adorned as I am.
We could spend time figuring out how you deal with that every morning.
Well, let's since there's another time day, constraint but, here, maybe yeah. Another time.
Yeah.
I want to point it out because I haven't cut or combed my hair since that injury. And it's because I told my son I wouldn't cut my hair until he got out of his chair. Maybe odd solidarity with him, but while you're staring at my dreadlocks like so many people do, I would ask you to consider the advances in the field of spinal cord injury research that have occurred in the last 6.5 years. Yesterday, a very esteemed group of researchers from the University of Minnesota came and testified at the Senate hearing about Governor Dayton's Blue Ribbon Panel. And it was no coincidence that those researchers represented two fields in particular of research, cancer and HIV. The reason is because the NIH has targeted over $10 billion to research those two disease processes. They are fabulous researchers, brilliant researchers, and there's a significant amount of money, a significant amount of resource in that field. Now, that means that while for us, the numbers of spinal cord injury patients in the United States equal the number of people with specifically HIV, 1.5 million. NIH establishes per year $3.4 billion to research HIV. It establishes less than $90 million for spinal cord injury. So we've had to do what we're doing today, our community across the country. We come to our legislatures and we appeal to you to recognize the disparity in research pipeline dollars. Virtually every advance that we have seen in these last 6.5 years have come from state-funded programs like we are seeking and like we have met with many of you about over this session. They're highlighted by collaborations not just among research institutions, but specifically between researchers and community advocates. From Florida's Miami Center to Cure Paralysis Project, to the Roman Reed Act in California, to Kentucky, to New York, New Jersey, there are 13 other states that have seeded money like this. Out of every single one of them have been the advances we have seen in the last 6.5 years, which is why we're here. In fact, just a couple of months ago, CNN reported again on the SCI project in Kentucky, showing a young man who was paralyzed, moving his lower extremities as a result of the interventions. This is important because that particular project is important because right now, as we speak, the Mayo is trying to institute a replication project of that particular project in Kentucky. Right now, they only have enough funds to do 2 people in that study. There are people in this room that could participate in a project of that nature, but it requires funding. It needs funding. This is one of the areas of study that is around the country, but also exists in Minnesota. And I've mentioned them to you before. Stem cells, growth factors, electronic devices, brain interfaces. There are a number of medical device innovations that are being applied to cure this disease. Unfortunately, last year, the Regenerative Medicine Act, which passed in the previous session, received 93 applicants for research grants. It granted 6 of them. None of them were for spinal cord injury, and none of them were for traumatic brain injury, because those are not really complementing the existing pipeline, which is, again, what draws us to you. We want to speed the advances that are happening from our community's advocacy to Minnesota and bring them here and fund them here. So we ask you to return House File 777 to the budget. We obviously, like others before us, are disappointed to find that it's not there, especially after we have met with so many of you who have decided to co-author and considered this a valuable addition to this bill. I'm sure you don't, with maybe notwithstanding Representative Nornes, you don't really care about what's going to happen to my hair. But I would ask you to please consider my son, and please consider the 10,005 other Minnesotans who live with paralysis every day, who cannot feel the touch of their loved one, who cannot go to the bathroom without an intervention, cannot stand, and a whole host of other complications that many of you may not be aware of, besides walking, which is a very common misconception. You can imagine how difficult it is to give this testimony today. Given the last time that we were here, there were tears shed by some of you, not by some of us, because you believed that this was critical and important to bring into this bill and into this session. So I would ask you again to reconsider that and reintroduce. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Rob Wudlick, is that correct?
Yeah.
Rob, stretch the mic up there. There you go.
A little, just like a corner, or is that it? See this?
It'll pick up okay, I think.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us today. We're here to fix a problem with spinal cord research funding. Because there is an inadequate amount of research support for our for our population. If there was adequate commitment for spinal cord research in our academic institutions, we would not have to be here testifying before you guys today. 5 years ago, this legislation was brought to the state capitol, and we have not seen any meaningful direct increase for funding in spinal cord research in the state. For 5 years, We have also petitioned our academic institutions for research funding in this field, and no fiscal response has been given. As a citizen outside of the institutional systems, we have no voice in their decision-making process. That is why it's important for the legislative committees to fund a disease-specific appropriation, in this case of spinal cord research, with community influence. This deficit in funding, which affects many, will most likely continue unless change happens from the state level. Other great existing programs, institutional programs, such as MnDrive and this regenerative medicine bill, and general research at the university is great for tackling larger health complications such as AIDS and cancer and diabetics and cardiac diseases. However, they have failed to commit to show the necessary funding in our direction. The closest thing the regenerative medicine program is funding for neuroscience is macular degeneration and funding for a generalized stem cell bank. They've made claims that they're directly funding spinal cord research, but have failed to back that up yet. As we've told you, similar state-funded spinal cord injury research programs in other states, like the one we were proposing, have shown success stories. And this program is based, the structure of this program is based off of federal level. The DOD even uses this model of citizen input to appropriate $30 million in spinal cord research funds. Community-based decisions of grant rewards will be the most effective, accountable, and reliable ways to ensure the best research ideas in the state get funded. If one institution has all the best ideas and the means to deliver, they have the right to convince and receive funds from a panel of appointed experts and community members relevant to this disease to decide so. Even low funding for this program will make an influence. Obviously, more funding would be appreciated and more influential, and it would help. This bill would establish baseline funding for new and existing projects. If $2 million a year were appropriated, that would account for $1 million per disease between brain and spinal cord research. About four to five small lab preclinical translational studies could be funded, and about one or two possibly human trials could start, with baseline funding assuming that the NIH and other outside sources would see the baseline as a sustainable source and jump in on that. There is a direct relevance for this bill to be in higher education. In the higher education budget, this funds medical research, which a large amount is most likely to go to the academic institutions, which would fall under this committee. This bill will put institutions such as the University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, HCMC, the Veterans Hospital, and many other respectable institutions in our state on the front line of spinal cord research, like it has in other states, and will attract top neuroscience medical researchers to Minnesota, to Minnesota's prestigious institutions. We ask that you amend or include this bill in the omnibus and give it the chance it deserves. We're a little further towards you. Excuse me. We're asking is for less than 1% that the state pays annually for care in this population, and is likely to decrease these costs with when functional improvements are able to be delivered to people like others in this room and myself who need them. I hope to report to this committee in 2 years from now the successes this bill has made instead of watching Minnesota fall behind in spinal cord research and innovations. Many of you believe this is a good idea. Now it's time to make this idea become a reality. With a surplus this year, this is the time to deliver. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We sit or stand for questions.
Thank you, Rob. We have a couple of questions. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Wadlock, for your presentation. I'm just most grateful for your being here again, and I don't think really probably any of us have an appreciation for the extraordinary efforts that you need to make to be here. So we really, really appreciate that. I think my question would be for President Kaler or any of the other potential testifiers from the University of Minnesota. Thank you. Thank you, President Kaler. My question is really, I'm just wondering if you have any insight to share with us about any projects, any research that the University of Minnesota is doing in this area. I was interested to hear about the citizen initiatives. I don't know to what degree any. I think you referenced Mr. Wadlock about the Department of Defense and just a model for gaining citizen input. I wasn't really tracking with what you said, but I'm wondering if the University of Minnesota utilizes any sort of input like that in determining what sort of research you might pursue.
Chair Nornes, Representative Pugh, that is a great question, and my understanding is that the great majority of our research is investigator-initiated, the basic science that addresses various disease states. That's my understanding, but again, I certainly there certainly could be programs about which I'm not aware, but perhaps the other testifiers will have more experience with that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and if I could ask Mr. Roderick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, there are approximately a dozen research projects at the University of Minnesota. In the state of Minnesota right now, there are about 26 or so that would fit the criteria for spinal cord injury, pardon me, not TBI. There are even more if we include TBI, but obviously you know that we're more connected to SCI. There are translational projects at the University of Minnesota currently, but actually not funded by the university. They are funded privately, a private donor, actually anonymous donor. For instance, with one of our research partners, it is not actually funded by the university itself. There are other multiple projects. There are basic science projects. Of course, you can imagine, I mean, we see the value in that. We see the value in that investigation because there's much about the injury that is not yet understood. So those things need to be funded. But obviously, you can imagine that we are a little more interested in the translational projects, the projects that are being tested in mammals and are poised to move across to humans. We're interested in the project, like I mentioned, at the Mayo that's ready to go into humans. This year. Those are the things that really get us kind of interested and motivated, but understand the need for those basic science investigational projects, some of which are being funded at the university, but as I said explicitly, the translational projects are not.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pugh.
And thank you to all of you. I'm most appreciative for that information. I'll look forward to continuing to pursue this. I share your disappointment for not having been a part of this bill at this point, and we will just look forward to continuing to work together to make a difference. And I think I'll just leave it at that. I'm just most grateful for all of this input. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. And I did have an opportunity to tour the Regenerative Medicine Center, the MnDrive Center, and the Pharmacology School. And all three of them are working on different components of both of the issues that you're discussing. And I actually got to go back into the lab with Dr. Tolar in the Stem Cell Research Center and look at the research being done about spinal cord regeneration, which was just stunning. And President Kaler, I wish you would have come with me to see it firsthand, and then you could probably speak better than I, but it's amazing work. And they are from an outside view looking in, it looks like they're right on the cusp of really being able to regenerate a spinal cord. It was pretty impressive, and the study was amazing. And also in the MnDrive Center, you know, we have $36 million in the base for the MnDrive initiative, which is, you know, they're actually venturing out into all kinds of things, including possibly addiction and other things, traumatic brain injury, all kinds of different things that they're doing. And I wish we had researchers here to explain it because it's incredibly complex. But President Kaler, could you, since you're there, could you just give us an idea specifically in these two areas what research that you will be looking at? And those are just a couple of things I happen to see in a two-hour, three-hour visit there at the U, but I'm certain that behind all the doors I didn't get to open, there was much more going on.
Chair Norton, Representative O'Neill, I have also toured Jacob Tolar's laboratory, and it is remarkable, and the stem cell work is important. I don't have a catalog of other work that's related to that in my head right now, but we certainly can provide you with that information.
Thank you, Chair. That would be great if we could just see, you know, again, I think that that's kind of an ongoing theme today as well, to just sort of see where the those dollars are being spent, both in research and in general. But it would be great to see, you know, specific research projects and how it's being funded and how much it's going in. You know, MnDrive alone, I said, was a $36 million project, and they're doing great things in just a year and a half or so, I think, since they've been up and operational. So I'd love to see more.
Any final comment there, Mr.
Yes.
Broderick?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative O'Neill, I have been to the Stem Cell Institute on many an occasion to meet with researchers there and to tour labs as well. And there are projects there that do excite us. Dr. Ann Parr's translational work, again, I would reiterate, is not funded by the university but privately. And in addition, some of the other entities that are there to provide research funds, like the collaboration project between the Mayo and the University of Minnesota. These are all great mechanisms. But I think one of the things that concerns us, and why, again, I started by talking about sort of the history of, for instance, the history of HIV research. That community for 35 years has been aggressive in their advocacy towards bringing attention to a disease that was killing their community. That led to where we are today, where there is a significant investment, because I think those folks understood something that we are beginning to understand. The market drives the industry. Industry drives research. And we are doing our best as a small community to initiate a voice within that economy to suggest that there be some investment in this particular brand of research, because it certainly appears to us that market forces are not there. Thank you.
Matthew, Rob, both of you, thanks for coming back today and testifying. We appreciate that. And
thank you.
We certainly hope that we can, down the road, be helpful to you. Right. Members, we need to return to the DE4 amendment. You should all have a copy, I assume. We have four amendments. The first one is the A15 amendment, which is an author's amendment. And if I could ask for House Research to just quickly walk through that amendment.
Thank you, Dr. Chair. So the A15 amendment contains three changes to the DE4 amendment. First, it corrects a drafting error in the living and miscellaneous expense that appears in the DE4 amendment and sets the living and miscellaneous expense at $7,900, which is the level that it was set at in the previous budget bill. In addition, there are two small changes to the language from Representative Erdahl's House File 384. First, there's additional language regarding the reporting requirements for the pilot program on page 6, line 26. It essentially asks that as part of the pilot upon completion of the pilot program, the report back to the legislature include recommendations for changing the section of statutes. And additionally, on page 13, line 9, the language in the DE4 says that MinSU schools must use a year-long student teaching model, and this language changes that must to a may to make it permissive to allow them to do so if they would choose to.
Thank you. Any questions on the A15? Representative Grunhagen.
Just a quick question. My understanding is on the state grant program, we do have a surplus in there yet, even with the shift, correct?
Yes.
Okay, then if there's a surplus and we're not using all the money up, which is my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, then why are we reducing from 8490 down to 7900?
Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, in the last biennium, the legislature set the living and miscellaneous expense at $7,900. Under statute, if there is more money than is needed for the main appropriations or for the main grants through the program in the second year of biennium, the Office of Higher Education is authorized to increase the living and miscellaneous expense in the second year of the biennium. So this is the amendment would return the living and miscellaneous expense to the level it was set at in 2013.
Okay. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is that necessary in order to free up the amount of money that's being shifted out of the state grant program?
Williams.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, so the $7,900 reflects what is in the spreadsheet. And so the original number that was included in the spreadsheet was based upon the $7,900, and there was an initial drafting error that had the different number in the bill.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I just want to be clear. So right now, the Office of Higher Education set the amount in the second year of the biennium at $8,490. For miscellaneous expenses, and in order to capture the amount of money that we want to shift out of the state grant program, we are by law decreasing that amount to $7,900.
Who wants to respond to that? Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, yes, the level that was in the 8,490 level that is in the bill currently was a drafting error that was there initially. But the level that was set in the previous bill was 7,900, and that was what was set in the previous biennium.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any information as a committee about what it actually costs for living and miscellaneous expenses for students? I mean, I get that this is a drafting error, and we've got right. Money that you want to move around and all that sort of thing, but this is $500, presumably, that a student would have, and I guess I don't know if there's any evidence of the real-world impact of that reduction, since we have we have money in the grant program. Is there anybody who can speak to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, I would defer to the Office of Higher Education staff if there's someone in the audience for them to talk sort of about what the implications of that would have.
Representative Winkler, do you want to restate your question for our testifiers?
Mr. Chair, if the Office of Higher Education could just put a real-world context about what a cost for living and miscellaneous expenses for students, what this $8,490 versus $7,900 means in the lives of students, and why it got set at that by the Office of Higher Education. I think that would be helpful background for us.
Please state your name for the record, then.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Meredith Fergus. I am with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I am the State Grant Analyst.
I'm Nikki Oliver. I'm the Office of Higher Education's Legislative Liaison. And Commissioner Pogemiller, based on yesterday's hearing, had us run some numbers on this, and we have the sheet that we can pass out for this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, to answer your question directly, most colleges estimate the non-tuition fee expenses for students, be it they live on campus, pay personal transportation expenses, books, those kinds of things, anywhere from $8,000 to $12,000. And those costs are typically at the higher end if they're at a two-year college, and at a lower end if they're at a four-year college, $8,000 to $12,000. We also have survey data from students who are 18 to 24 in general, what they pay on non-tuition fee expenses if they're enrolled in college, and that number is about $12,500 on average. In terms of what the office set in the governor's proposal, we actually recommended that the living expenses be set to the essentially the federal poverty level for a single person for a nine-month period, which in the current year is $8,828. So the LME that exists under in practice or in effect today of $8,490 is approximately $400 lower than the federal poverty level. The amount in current law is, of course, $7,900, and that's what it will go back to unless there is a change made.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Fergus, so just so I'm clear about how this functions in this bill, this dollar amount, is that what the state grant program will fund up to, including all sources for the students? So the idea is that you would not, that the state grant would not fund a student beyond that level if, for example, they got some assistance from their college or university, or they had some other family source of funds. Is that intended to be kind of a ceiling on what they would receive under the grant program?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, it's more of a standard living allowance. So this is what we estimate students would have to pay outside of tuition and fees to be a college student. We then take that amount into consideration with the year tuition and fees that they pay, and then allocate a portion of that to the family based on their income and assets, to the student, as well as to the federal Pell Grant program and then the state grant program. So it's those total costs, both living expenses and tuition and fee expenses together.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, as I understand that this is what's in statute, but as I understand the amendment, what we're doing is for students in the state grant program, we're basically creating a budget for them that includes a cost of living for 9 months that is below the federal poverty level for a single person and would have a greater impact on two-year students than on four-year students because they tend to have more outside, I suppose, transportation and other kinds of living expenses beyond people who tend to be on campus and probably a little more self-contained.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, that is correct.
Are any other questions about the A15 amendment? If not, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
A15 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A8 amendment. That's Representative Norton. Would you like to explain that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is part of the college completion language, and if you'll remember, when I had that bill hearing, it was with exactly the same language for MNSCU as the university. That language was worked on with MNSCU, and I had not at that time had a chance to talk with the University of Minnesota about whether that language was the identical language was appropriate. Since that time, they've stepped forward and done some thinking. I sent it all to you in advance, and this is the similar concept, but some slightly different twists in order to be accomplished, they believe, and appropriate for the University of Minnesota, too. So with the same goals in mind, it's just a slightly different way to get to this, hopefully the same ends, which is college completion in 4 years for far more Minnesotans.
Any questions of the author? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That amendment is also adopted. Next amendment is A13. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This amendment is simply clarifying, making sure that we are in line with the CLARI, which is the federal reporting. We had put in the bill initially that it was that they should report on their fiscal year, and it should be calendar year. And so we want to make sure that we're not making things more onerous and difficult, but lining them up with the Federal CLARI Act. So this is just clarifying that it is, in fact, aligned with the CLARI Act.
Any questions of Representative O'Neill? Not all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. We have one remaining amendment, the A9 amendment. Representative Bernardi, do you wish to offer that?
Yes, I wish to offer that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Would you then like to explain it?
Yes. I would like to, I want to bring this forward. I was really actually kind of surprised. Like when Representative Norton was talking about her bill as the college completion bill, maybe this is the college completion bill in less than 4 years bill, because this is a bill that really helps get the roadblocks out of the way for students who are taking college credit coursework in high school. And it seemed like all session, that's what we were really working on, trying to get students out of college as quick as possible, trying to streamline processes, and trying to make rigorous coursework available for our high school students. And this is very complementary to the great efforts that's being done by Representative, I don't know if I'm going to say his name right, Heintzman, as well as Representative Erdahl. And it's complementary. It's not, we met with a House researcher, and he communicated with both the parties to let us, and myself, to let us know that this is not duplicative. And so I was hoping to see this in the bill. This is a bill that, like I said, for students, well, I hadn't said this yet, but for students that are taking concurrent enrollment, college in the school, taking advanced placement courses, taking international baccalaureate courses, that the college credit they earn is transferred with transparency, and the institution is held with accountability to get that credit transferred for that student. I'm all about getting out the barriers for students. Some students just, you know, they get rejected and they'll just say, okay, it didn't transfer, when the policy is on their side that it ought to be transferred. In fact, the language that I used in this bill was from Minscu's own transfer curriculum policy, and they follow most of the policy, or try to, but not always. And so this is creating transparency that it actually is, the students know that this is what they ought to be doing. And then I added language to make it clear that it counted that high school students' credits would be transferred as well. And the intent of the law, the intent of their policy is to do that, but until I brought this up, once I brought this up, they did say that it has been brought to their attention that not all colleges and universities are following this procedure. And so I asked my school district, what would you like me to do? Because students in my school district, and I'm sure all of yours as well, are having problems with this. And my school superintendents, advocating for students, said, move forward with this bill. We did not have anyone that opposed it in our committee. I was hoping that we could create common ground, have a suite of these bills go through that help our students, and I was really disappointed that it was, that mine was left out of that package. I did talk to Representative Nornes before committee, and he said that we could try to work on this before we get to the floor, and that's we're going to meet together and try to see how we can move forward with this. And I really appreciate that offer, and I'll look forward to meeting with you on that and working something out. So with that, I am going to withdraw this amendment for right now.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will be talking. That's all of the amendments. Now back to House File 845 as amended. Any comments among members? Representative Leon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we've been going over the committee and all the different proposals and everything throughout the session, I guess when we come to the finish line here, I have to say I am very disappointed in the target that House leadership has given this committee. I think $53 million target is far, well, really not taking full advantage of the opportunity we have right now with the budget surplus and everything, not to mention all the progress and work we made over the last 2 years to keep tuition and higher education affordable for students. So, you know, with that, I really hope that we can get in a better position as we go forward, as we move through conference committee. But, you know, again, I just really can't overstate how disappointed disappointing it is to have a target like this in consideration, like I say, all the work that we did over the last couple of years to keep tuition low, pitting the two systems basically against each other, having to pick winners and losers, and also having to take money from the state grant program, I think is a really serious detriment to the integrity of that program. There's a lot of things we could do with that surplus money, such as increasing LME caps, increasing tuition caps, extending the prorated tuition for part-time students to all Minsky, U of M, private school students. So I guess with that, I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lean. I can only say one thing, that you know, none of us are really excited about what we have here, but as a former chair who has in the past always had negative targets, to me, this is pretty good. I mean, I hate to make light of it, but it's at least positive. And as we go forward, I think it's bound to get better. That's our hope all the way around. So we have to be optimistic as we move forward. We need your support to get there. And I hope we can have that as we move forward. As we discuss it further, we'll have to have a conference committee, all of those things. So. Any other comments? We have Representative Pawlowski.
Representative Narnes, you don't anticipate improving this in Ways and Means, do you? Would there be the possibility of an improvement in this target in Ways and Means, and then a reassessment of where the money's coming from and where it's going?
It's always possible that there might be, sympathy for us, if you want to put it that way. I think they understand the pressure that they have put us under with the target we have. And so, I mean, we're not going to let up on trying to find a source of some additional funding. And especially, you know, I feel bad about the university being basically left out. That's something that if we could do something there. So I don't know. But to answer your question, we're going to keep working at it. And somewhere along the line, there might be a revised target, we hope.
Yeah. Representative Narnes, I hope that's true. It isn't usually the policy to make significant reductions up in Ways and Means. Usually, when you're in Ways and Means and there's a correction, it is flatter the other way.
Yeah.
There have been rumors about, for instance, the Ag Finance Bill, that there may be improvements in the Ag Finance Bill in Ways and Means. Not huge improvements, but some improvements. And I hope you're right that there might be improvements in Ways and Means.
Yeah.
But Representative Norris, I understand your last target was the worst target I'd ever seen. It was by $500 million bad. It's just unfortunate that when we have a surplus that we can't invest in higher education. A good chunk of this bill, we're going to see increases in tuition and increases in debt at a time of a surplus. And we've lived through a recession. Minnesota is now a state that's doing very well. So I would hope that we would not put any more debt on the backs of students in higher education.
I need to point out that we do freeze some tuition and we lower some tuition. We're, you know, where we can, I think we've done some good things. But there are some other areas where, It might feel different. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to acknowledge all of our students that are going to college out there, whether they're fresh out of high school. Actually, they could still be in high school. They're changing careers. They've been laid off. I have sympathy for these students because it's not about sympathy for us or the pressure on us as a committee. Mm-hmm. Or us being left out. It's our students are being left out in the success and the economy of our state. We have a $1.9 billion surplus that we ought to be investing in our students who are going to keep moving us forward and making our state successful. Our number one return on investment, in my opinion, is education. And the quickest return on that investment is in higher ed. It doesn't take long to get that return on investment to be producing positive results for Minnesota. So I believe this bill is very short-sighted, and I want to keep us focused on who is being hurt, who we should be sympathetic for, and who this is putting pressure on, because we used to say that we were balancing, the budget was being on the balance on the, this is a tongue twister, that the budget was being balanced on the backs of students. We ought not to be balancing the ever balancing the budget on the backs of students, but especially when we have a $1.9 billion surplus.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you for the chairing the committee and the work that you've done. I know you've made tough choices based on the target that you've been given. I think one of the things I've learned since being at the legislature, and I especially appreciate being on the Higher Ed Committee, both in the last biennium under Chair Pawlowski and under your leadership, I continue to learn, is that higher ed funding generally across the United States has been a declining percentage of the state budget. And one of the reasons for that is the HHS budget has been an increasing percentage of state budgets. And one of the things I've learned, having served on the HHS committee, and I can't remember the exact year, but probably a couple of decades ago, and that's off the top of my head, HHS used to be 15% of our state budget, our state spending, okay? And obviously we funded higher ed at a much higher percentage during that period of time. Today, HHS is 30% and growing exponentially of our budget. And it's, according to former state demographer Tom Gillespie, it's going to, if it keeps growing and we don't reform that area, it's going to crowd out higher ed funding, K-12 funding, and road and bridge funding, just to name a few. That was his report, I think, 2010, 2011. So I would urge all of us, if we want additional funding in higher ed, we do have to look at reforming the HHS budget, okay? And we have a number of reforms, some of them controversial, that we have passed in the HHS budget. And I would just urge all of my colleagues to understand that if we don't correct the growth in HHS financing, especially with the demographic change that's coming in this state and across our nation, we're going to be even under more pressure going forward as far as funding for higher ed and the things that we need to continue to be a leading medical and research state. And the last thing I'd say is that I can't remember where I read it, but there was this story about seven fat years and seven lean years, and if they would have eaten all the grain during the seven fat years, they would have starved during the seven lean. So we do need to create a competitive tax and regulatory structure so our private sector can continue to grow and thrive and generate even more tax revenues for us in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would add just one thing, that the tax bill this year that's being worked on actually has some good things in there for students, potentially. So that's right. You know, we'll help them anywhere we can. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Grunhagen. I've never heard a scriptural support for the Laffer curve before.
I read it. I couldn't remember where I read it.
And if it's in there, I haven't run across it yet. But you may be right in some larger senses about HHS, but the fact is that we have seven fat years, and you're choosing to engage in a eating orgy on tax cuts, not on any kind of long-term investment in the state's future.
We're getting close to where we all have to eat here. It's,
Mr. Chair, to use the eating analogy, everyone else is going on a diet, and especially our kids, apparently, who are expected to live below the poverty level and take on debt just to get an education that benefits all of us. And I wouldn't say that this is the fault of the target. This is the fault of anybody who wants to cut taxes by $2 billion at this point and eat up all of the budget surplus in these kind of tax approaches rather than actually funding the things that are going to help students and invest in the future for the next generation. So I'm certainly going to be voting no on your bill. I have some criticism of
choosing some students to succeed and not others to not get an increase, even within the target that you have. But the real test for this bill, as in almost every other area of the budget, is that if you feel bad about what you're spending in higher education, the vote that counts is the tax bill. That's the one that is using up all the money that could otherwise be going to students in this state.
Thank you for those comments. Any other? We have used up our committee time, but I don't think we've got a rush of people coming in here. So, but I guess we're ready to vote. So if that if we're ready to vote, then I think we should.
Mr.
Representative Bernardi?
No.
No? Okay. Members, all those in favor of House File 845 as amended to be moved to the Ways and Means Committee, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The bill passes. Move on, moving. Members, thank you very much. And we're adjourned.